Revolution full-color maps and full-color photographs, as well as detailed information and analysis to help you zero in on the best places to live, the ideal location for cabins and vacation homes, as well as safe and unsafe areas. Get Prudent Places USA for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438 to order on the web or at...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion, delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Sheila O'Connor Ambrose. Sheila O'Connor Ambrose. But we're going to be talking about a book that she edited, but was written by one of her teachers, Elizabeth Fox Genovese. It's a book called Marriage, the Dream, the Refuse to Die. Now, that's sort of an unusual title, Marriage, the Dream, the Refuse to Die, but I'm going to let Sheila talk about what this is. And then within the background, apparently, the author was a lifelong socialist, Marxist, humanist. But as she began looking and seeing what was happening in her society, and of course she was the head of a women's study group at the university where she taught, she began to realize that, of course, maybe this whole feminist movement really was sort of a dead end, because marriage has been an institution since the beginning of time, and you abandon Cindy marriage, what happens to society? So without further ado, do I have your name? Is it correct? Is it Sheila O'Connor Ambrose? Sheila? Sheila there?
Yes, here I am.
All right, fine. Is that the correct pronunciation of your name?
Yes, it is.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about Elizabeth and who she was, why her views are important today?
Well, she was a very, very dear friend of mine. She passed away in January 2007. And at the time of her death, she was served, President Bush had appointed her to serve on the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Governing Council, and she was a world-famous historian, wrote many books, many, many articles. Her resume was about 27 pages long. And you're right, her father was a historian of European history at Cornell, and Betsy, as all her students called her Betsy, and I find it hard to call her anything else, but she went to Bryn Mawr and then to Harvard, and she was among that first generation of very influential women scholars. And, you know, Betsy was a Marxist, but it's very interesting in talking about her as such, because a lot of what she believed as a Marxist, she was what I guess we could call a communitarian Marxist, which means that she always thought that we were part of something larger than ourselves, that every individual was part of a community. And as such, she really believed that, kind of to take the words of John Donne, you know, no man is an island entire unto himself. And I think there's a lot that Christians can really identify with that. And then when she was a feminist, she started the nation's first PhD program in women's studies. And I joined that in 1991. That was the first year. And I was a pro-life pretty conservative Catholic, and I had gone to University of Dallas, and a professor there had told me, because I was very interested in women writers, and he said, oh, you really have to meet Elizabeth Fox Genovese. He said, she's a Marxist, but she's a reasonable Marxist. And I had no idea what that meant, but I was intrigued, and I met her, and did I just love her. She was just first-rate intellectual, very ideologically open, meaning her classroom...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a minute here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Sheila O'Connor Ambrose. That's Sheila O'Connor Ambrose, and she's going to be talking about a book that was written by a close friend of hers, Elizabeth Fox Genovese. Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who was a Marxist professor, who was a very liberal socialist individual, but she apparently, as time went by, she began to modify some of her views, especially as far as marriage. Now, she established one of the first PhD programs in the United States as far as women's liberation and women's studies are concerned. And of course, there was a time when this seemed to be the wave of the future. We've got to liberate women from the shackles of marriage so they can accomplish what they're supposed to accomplish in the world. And so what actually happened to Elizabeth? Why did she change her views, do you know?
Well, you know, even when she was a Marxist and a feminist, she was pretty unique in her views, and she got a lot of, she was very much attacked by her quote-unquote sister feminists for that actually Betsy always strongly defended marriage and defended family, and she was very critical of abortion, even when she was a pro-life or pro-choice feminist. She thought that abortion, that really there was a life there, and that society had a claim on that right, and that no woman had an absolute right to her body. Well, you can imagine the sort of trouble that even what maybe pro-lifers would see as, you know, that's such a mild criticism, but in those circles that was really, no dissent was allowed on the question of abortion. So when Betsy did convert to Catholicism and become a Christian, she really found an intellectual home, especially on the life issues. And she was very blessed with John Paul II as, you know, his voice of moral authority in the world, defending life and defending the unborn and all those who, you know, are defenseless and voiceless in our society.
Well, I think the most intelligent people, you know, of course, we have a lot of liberals who say, you know, we want to be free, we want to do whatever we want to, but, you know, as you grow older, you come to the realization that maybe we don't have all the answers.
Yes.
We do need a moral authority, and to the evangelical Christian,
yes,
it would be God, and I'm sure to the Catholic would be exactly the same thing.
Yes.
Hold on just a moment here.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Sheila O'Connor Ambrose is our guest today, and she, of course, was a friend. She helped to edit the book, Marriage, the Dream That Refused to Die. And apparently, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, although she was a feminist in every respect, she thought that perhaps abortion was morally wrong. And eventually, of course, towards the end of her life, she converted to Catholicism. Now, here's a professor that formed one of the first women's studies, you know, a PhD program for women's studies. And, of course, women's studies is all about liberating women as far as marriage and children and really freeing them up to do what they want to. But it is of my contention, and I'd like to know what Sheila feels about it, that if freedom is not the ability to do whatever we want to, but the ability to do what we should do according to God's rules.
Yes. Well, you know, Betsy has a great line in the book where she says, you know, and she was one of the world's leading scholars on slavery in the United States, but she said, you know, in modern times, freedom has brought its own forms of slavery. So I think she understood very well what you are, what you're saying. But you know, she it's interesting because when I joined women's studies, you know, she had a very special vision of what women's studies ought to be, and she really truly believed that it ought to have genuine diversity. It ought to be open to anybody who was serious about these questions. And unfortunately, that's not really how it's played out in most women's studies departments. It's much more about, well, pretty much radical feminism.
Well, Christy, isn't really radical feminism and Marxism, aren't they, really intertwined very, very strongly?
Well, yes and no. I think Elizabeth would say that you know, she always had, even as a Marxist, she always had a very strong critique of individualism. And she, one of her most famous books written in the early 90s is called Feminism Without Illusions, and a critique of individualism. And what she meant by that is, you know, that very modern, deeply secular view of individualism, which replaced the old order. And marriage was, you know, it's no accident that marriage was the institution that grew out of that old order. You know, the old order, how the world was, it was a series of organic social relations, not, you know, the way the world used to work. It was never about individual freedom, individual desire. But since the Enlightenment, and, you know, on the other hand, Betsy, as critical as she was of that, she also saw what a great service it's done to mankind. She, you know, this is, it was that abolished slavery as any, you know, sort of respectable social institution. It gave women tremendous rights and tremendous opportunities in the world. Go on down the list. She's not somebody who said we could ever put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. But she really begged us, and she was a first-rate historian. She knew what she was talking about. She really begged us to see, to understand what this language of individual rights, which sees that the individual's personal happiness, personal desire, is really the only authority there is. She asks us to see, what is this doing to the world we live in, and the sense that there are any binding connections among us as people?
Well, you know, it's a long, long way from being a Marxist, and yeah, because Marxism is really grounded in atheism,
yes,
to be becoming a convert to Catholicism. What motivated her to change? In other words, this is a change in your whole worldview.
Well, as I said, I don't think she really changed her worldview. She was always concerned, as an historian, with the human dimension in history, you know, real people struggling with real life. She said many times, I don't have a radical bone in my body. You know, she and her husband, who also was a leading historian, they never had much patience with people on the left, very liberal people who, you know, simply said, well, the world is what I want to make of it. I no one has any right to tell me what to do. I get to make those rules. And Betsy saw forever, she saw that, wait a minute, that's no way to run the world. That's no way to have social order. That's no way to protect people who are defenseless, who need our help. And I think for a long time, obviously, as a Marxist, she thought maybe somehow the state could provide those answers. But when she converted to Catholicism, I think she found a real intellectual home in Catholicism, in Christianity, and her fullest voice came out, and it was really powerful. Her writing since her conversion in the mid-90s, I'm working now on editing a volume of them, and they're profound. They really ask us to step back and say, you know, sort of like the story of, she was very taken with the biblical story of Lazarus and the rich man, and she said many times when people read that, they think, Well, the rich man was wrong because he didn't give Lazarus food. He didn't, you know, A, B, or C. And she said, the rich man's great sin was he never even saw Lazarus. And that we have to be able to see people as people like ourselves, much less, you know, we have to see people as Jesus sees us and see Jesus in people. That was very important to her, that ability to see others and to see that we are not autonomous beings, like, you know, the John Donne's No Man Is an Island, but that we actually are not human unless we are in relation to each other. And she was very moved by John Paul II saying, it's sort of like the Holy Trinity, you know, God isn't God unless he's somehow, you know, in relation to the others. And she saw that as you know, a very important place to start with all of this.
Well, you know, I started out in life as a very liberal individual after going to the University of California when I was quite young and really having not knowing quite what I believed in. But I think I'm just as idealistic today as I ever was. The only thing is that I realize that I don't have all the answers to the problems of the world, and nobody does. The only way we're going to have a better world is to change people. We're not going to do it by ideology, but by making people really have to turn to a power superior to ourselves, who says, this is right, this is wrong. Play by the rules, you'll be happy. Don't play by the rules, you're going to have nothing but problems. That's what the Ten Commandments is all about. Well, Cynthia, what do you think finally motivated you to actually embrace something which is, you know, it certainly is very, very strict in its beliefs?
Yes.
Certainly the Catholic Church, the true Catholic Church, there's no two ways about abortion. Abortion's wrong.
That's right.
You don't compromise on this as a true Catholic. And many of our Catholic friends, certainly, I feel, respect them. At least they'll take a strong stand on this, which so many of our Protestant ministers are so mealy-mouthed about it. But certainly, there's no middle ground as far as abortion and these other issues, these other moral issues, and sir, as far as marriage is concerned.
Yes.
Certainly, the Protestant Church has compromised on marriage. The Catholic Church still adheres to many of the old ideas.
That's right. And you know, and Betsy really respected that. But I think just in terms of, she always, just in terms of faith itself, she always, unlike her husband who identified himself as an atheist, Betsy always identified herself as a non-believer. I think she was never quite sure. And then I think it was several things. It was, first of all, the collapse of socialism. She and her husband, as I said, were exceptionally intellectually honest. And when that happened, instead of burying their heads in the sand, they said, you know what, we really have to rethink this. We were wrong about this. And I think the second thing was her recognition of the people on the left and feminists' absolute hardcore commitment to abortion, you know, no questions tolerated. That was very eye-opening for her. And then I think the other thing was, you know, I had come into her life around that period, and we became very, very good friends. And she wrote a conversion story, and she says in part that it was exposure to my faith, because, you know, Catholicism can be, you know, it can be a very ritualistic faith. And so there, you know, this was very much a part of the fabric of my life. And so I wasn't proselytizing or anything, but I think exposure through a genuine friendship really, Betsy really saw something. And she said, the thing is, she never believed that that could ever be hers. And then I think that's where grace came in for her. She said she never had the sort of St. Paul moment where she was knocked off the horse, but she really did have that growing sense of God, of, you know, a personal relationship with Christ. So it was very, very powerful to witness her humility and her genuine embrace of this was just that. And you know, it, just on a very personal level, we would go to church together, and she wanted so to get it right. You know, she wanted to make sure she was kneeling correctly or crossing herself. You know, and here was this absolute amazing Renaissance woman who had, you know, was very powerful and very authoritative in her own way. And here she was.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're talking to Sheila O'Connor Ambrose, and she's talking about how her friend Elizabeth Fox Genovese, you know, actually, when she decided she really wanted, of course, to accept the Catholic faith, wanted to become, you know, a part of this. And as Elizabeth says, Sheila says, there's a great deal of ritual, and of course, but she wanted to become part of this. She wanted this to become part of her life. Would that be right?
Yes.
How old was she?
Very, very genuine way.
How long before she died did this take place?
It was about 11 years.
Well, you know, each of us in our own way, if we profess to be Christians, is a witness to others. And
yes.
Hopefully, especially when you do talk radio. And, you know, if you, if I certainly do not deal with people, you know, as in a Christian manner, that would turn anybody listening to the programs away from Christianity. And I'm sure in your witness to Elizabeth, perhaps not proselytizing, but just in what you had and how you presented and how you lived your life, she could see that there was something there that was unique and different in comparison with so many liberals. That, you know, the trouble with so many liberal families is they have no standards. There is no close relationship between a husband and wife. And mm-hmm. when you get tired of it, why, you just get rid of your husband or your wife and you move on to the next partner.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting you should say that. You know, I think, you know, Betsy and I were very close, and she became very close with my family. I'm one of nine children, and, you know, beautiful, beautiful parents, and she was very, very close to them, and saw my mother they saw each other as real sisters in Christ. And so that, you know, she really was family to me, and also when she did come into the church, I had the honor of being her godmother, which was extraordinary.
Well, certainly, you know, the issue of marriage, because marriage, you know, today is in real trouble in our society. In fact, it's in my community, it's been said that for every marriage, there's a divorce.
Yes.
That for every marriage, there's a divorce. We know that, certainly in many areas, 50% of Christian, or I should say evangelical Christian, marriages end in divorce. That's a pretty sad commentary.
Yes.
I don't know what it is in the Catholic Church, but it's...
Oh, it's pretty much the same.
Right. We're on the same
yeah.
pickle, as it were.
And isn't that, yeah, that's... I hate to admit it, but yeah.
Well, no, Chris, the thing is that what was her message about marriage? Because this
yeah.
is really something that we got to get back to fundamentals. I mean, if you don't know how you got the mess you are, well, you're never going to get out of it. You got to retrace your steps. And why is marriage important? And why did Elizabeth feel that she needed to write a book about the importance of marriage?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because the book, half of it is... these three lectures that she was invited to Princeton University as a very distinguished lecturer, and she was invited to speak on anything she wanted. And this was in late 2003, and she decided to speak on marriage. And I'm so glad she decided that, because these are very, very important lectures and essays in this book. Back to what I said, her critique of individualism. You know, her sense was, in this society, because the individual has primacy, that, you know, that's so seductive to all of us because, well, it sounds so American, doesn't it? It's, you know, freedom of choice.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in
okay.
just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I was just asking Sheila really about this whole concept of marriage, which is the purpose of this book. Marriage, the dream that refuses to die. And suddenly Elizabeth now, she's converted to Catholicism, and she's beginning to look at the world through different eyes. And suddenly the liberal ideology is you do what you want to. You want to get rid of your wife? Go ahead. Want to get rid of your husband? You want to have an affair? Go ahead. No rules, no regulations, no restrictions. But of course, she began to realize that this was a one-way street to disaster. So you pick the story up there, please, Sheila.
Yes, and she said, really, we're at a precipice right now. You know, that absolute supremacy of the individual freedom to make his own happiness. She said, really, what that has become is that we can do anything we want with a clear conscience. And not only can we do anything we want, no one can criticize us. I mean, how dare if the, you know, personal happiness is the measure of all good, then whatever someone chooses for his or her happiness, who am I to question it? But she said, really, what happens is we just now are faced with all of these most important questions of human life and human value. They're all just lifestyle. She hated that term, lifestyle choices. And she said, now we're learning lifestyle choices include every imaginable sexual sin. And you know, lifestyle, but she says, you know, not just same-sex marriage. It's far before that, as we mentioned before, you know. It's also the choice, well, you can abort or not abort. You can marry or not marry. You can bear a child within marriage or outside of marriage. You can cohabitate or not. Go on down the line, and she said, logically, there's no reason not to add polygamy to this. She said, you know, when marriage as the union between one man and one woman has been dissolved into just a flood of lifestyle options, then really, how can we say that anybody's choice is wrong? Because the truth is, choices conflict, right? You may choose something, I may choose something. If I'm weaker than you, if I don't have the resources you have, who am I then to tell you that what you've chosen is wrong? So she really worried that this had become totally subjective. There was no objective morality whatsoever. Everything's completely objective and subjective. And she said, you know, if you live in a world where the subjective perspective is supreme, then again, all those incredibly important, weighty questions about human life are totally personal then. So who's to say you can't kill the child in the womb? Who's to say you can't just get divorced and, you know, family becomes quote-unquote families, you know, one lifestyle choice among many? And she said, you know, it's just sort of like so many cobwebs that all of human history is just being brushed aside. And she really did believe we were at a precipice.
And I think that really is so true. I mean, certainly if you go back through history, and I mean, there was marriage in ancient Rome and in ancient Greece, and marriage has always been out there. Certainly there's always been aberrations as well, but the family was always the basis of any organized society. And suddenly in America, we're so much smarter than all of our predecessors, and we think we can do away without marriage.
Yeah, and you know, she said it did in sort of the old social order. You know, marriage wasn't even about love until relatively recently. It's not that you couldn't love somebody, but you know, it was too important a matter to leave up to love. Where, you know, you think of Jane Austen's novels, you know, you can really get it wrong. Now, Betsy thought love was a very important part of marriage, but it does make us thoughtful, does it not, about how important marriage was seen to social order throughout history. And now, you know, there was a very disturbing essay in the New York Times this weekend in the style section, written by a young man, a college student in California. Sounds like a very nice man, but he was talking about the hookup culture at I forget which university he was in, but he said, you know, dating just messes up casual sex. You know, casual sex is great. It's all about being in the moment, all of that. You know, go on down the list. But he ends the essay for all of his celebration of you know, casual sex. He ends the essay saying, sort of like echoing the title of this book, you know, The Dream That Refuses to Die. He says, but what if we can't get beyond ourselves and learn to sacrifice to be with one another? What is in store for us? And I think Betsy was really asking the same question.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest today is Sheila O'Connor Ambrose, and we're just sort of talking about the stability of marriage, the importance of marriage. You know, I can remember the time when we started having the idea of co-educational dorms, and you'd have co-educational dorms, boys and girls having rooms on the same floor, and then you had your co-educational bathrooms and your co-educational showers, and some of the schools are now even allowing boys and girls to in the college dorms to move in with one another. And, you know, where does all of this end? Well, I think it ends where, pretty close to where we are today, where we have 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease. Now, that's just a viral disease. That doesn't include AIDS or syphilis or gonorrhea or lymphopathy venereum and the other diseases we had. When I was a young doctor just taking my training, we only had 5 sexually transmitted diseases. We got about 20 of them now. And that's the end of in a society that happens when there are no rules, when people do whatever they want to. And what a heartache this must be for 60 million people who suddenly realize that maybe there really are rules and I broke them and I'm going to be punished with it.
Maybe nature has rules.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we're suffering as individuals almost inescapably from this. I mean, we can proclaim the freedom to do whatever we want, but if nature has rules, we're going to end up with a sexually transmitted disease. And I'm not sure our young people are really prepared to understand all of this. But beyond that, it's economist recently estimated that a conservative estimate that family fragmentation in our society due to divorce and single motherhood costs our society $112 billion a year. That's more than the war in Iraq. And these are recurring costs, and that's simply just economic costs for taxpayers and also lost tax revenue. But when you start to think of the human cost of this, that, you know, what is it to grow up in a society in which nobody even believes we have the ability to sacrifice our own interests for the common good?
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Sheila O'Connor Ambrose. We're talking about the book Marriage, the Dream That Refuses to Die. And it was written by Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who had passed away here last year. But anyway, of course, Sheila was her friend, and Sheila helped to edit the book. Before we go on, Sheila, would you like to, do you have a website? Or would you like to tell our listeners how they can get copies of the book, Marriage, the Dream
sure.
That Refuses to Die?
Yes, they can go to Amazon.com, or they can go to, the publisher of the book is ISI.org, and they can find the book there as well. Also, Barnes & Noble, though Barnes & Noble has the wrong title. It's something like Marriage, a Brief Defense of Our Most Important Institution, and that's sure a great title, but they may have a little bit of trouble finding the book at Barnes & Noble.
All right. Is there a website or anything I'd like to get out?
Just I would say ISI.org.
All right. ISI.org. And so the book is written by Elizabeth Fox Genovese, and it's really a very touching book. And of course, it's something that we need to really talk about, because you point out in the book, or as Elizabeth pointed out in the book, I mean, marriage is an institution because it tames men, and they have a responsibility. They have to look after the woman. They have to look after the children. And they can't be out cavorting all over. And then, of course, the same thing as far as women. Women, of course, want, many of them would be much more prone to be promiscuous. But within the confines of a marriage with a true commitment for life, for better, for worse, through sickness and health, forsaking all others until death do us part. Forsaking all others. I mean, those are such important words, and I think most people don't even listen to them. But of course, that's really what it's all about. Because of course, if you violate your marriage vow, your partner will never forgive you.
Mm-hmm. And if you contrast the, you know, speaking about the weight of words, if you contrast the vocabulary of the sort of old world that marriage grew out of, it was words like sacrifice, stability, moral and social cohesion, community, obligations, covenants, responsibilities, duties. You know, you get the idea. Compare that with the vocabulary of individual rights, the vocabulary that we live with all the time. And that's, you know, it's very different. Self-determination, personal freedom, choice, privacy, autonomy. And again, it gets back to, well, if something feels good, why not do it? And we find it harder and harder as a society to really offer people a real reason to get married and to stay married, and to offer children that sort of secure, loving, stable environment in which they can fully flourish. It's really kind of a disaster out there.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, we have a real problem. In fact, you know, of course, you look at the Muslim culture. I mean, maybe they have four wives, but at least you have to be true to your four wives. You're supposed to be. And you get caught in a sexual liaison. Believe me, the punishment for both men and women is pretty horrible. And I don't necessarily believe that I would not want to legalize that. And yet you can see why some people would convert to the Muslim faith, because they want something with values, and they look at our society as totally decadent. And they are right.
It's cultural.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, but at the end of the day, even for, you know, ordinary Americans just struggling to make sense out of their lives, I think it's still the dream that refuses to die.
Right.
I mean, you know, even among women who, my husband's a college professor, and he recently he was invited to the reunion. It's a very, it's an elite, you know, one of the top liberal arts colleges, and he was talking to some of the graduates. I think they were in their early 30s, and, you know, Manhattanites, and very sort of Sex in the City, sort of, you get the idea. And you know, they all want to get married, and they really do. And that's an interesting question, because in a world in which, for many women, for many elite women, there is no compelling reason to get married. You know, why would you? Even for them, the dream refuses to die. But I think also as a society, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what kind of world are we going to live in if no one is willing to do the very messy, you know, what's been called the human business of society, you know, making and caring for babies, educating them, you know, all of these. You know, beyond that, just even the world, you know, creating symphonies and volunteer organizations and all of that. You know, if people aren't willing to do that in a committed way, then the state steps in and does all of those things. And that's, I think Betsy's fear was, if you do away with an institution, you know, if we look at our society, it's made up primarily of the market, the state, family, and church, and education. But if you so weaken family, and then by extension the church, then all you're going to do is give even more and more power to the state, and to the market in our lives. And parents have a hard enough time now sort of keeping that at bay, don't we?
Well, you know, because people never talk about what's really going on for Europe when you see the end result of this. I mean, it takes 2.1 children per family to reproduce the family. And in France, I think it's 1.4 children per family. The same
France
in Germany.
France has the highest rate, I believe.
And Italy's 1.2 children per family. You know, and in Russia, they're just dying off. They're losing 1 million people a year.
Yeah.
And the only way to keep up the population is allowing all the Muslims to come into the country, but the Russian nationals, the men are dying off at 50 to 55 years of age, and then of course they're not reproducing. They're down about 1.2 children, and they're losing 1 million people a year. That's the end result, of course, of a country that turns its back against principles and marriage. And you know, abortion is so prevalent there. It's a major means of health control.
That's right.
Increasingly, it's becoming here in America, although I understand statistics are a little bit better. At least some of our young women and men are beginning to realize the importance of maybe following God's rules. That's really the only hope we have for the preservation of society.
Well, and you know, I was talking to someone the other day who said, well, the great thing about, you know, so he was talking actually about, like, the old, Italian family and the Spanish and...
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.